Connecticut today for a Thursday, the 16th of April, keeping an eye again on the coronavirus outbreak. We discussed the role of Communist China, the ruling party elite in Beijing, and their manipulation of the World Health Organization with an expert in that field and on world communism. We spoke with a professor from Southern Connecticut State University about the challenges of educating K through 12 kids at home. Of course, we locked in on Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus update, and we spoke with Tim Phelan. He heads the Connecticut Retail Merchants Association about the challenges merchants around the state are facing during the COVID-19 outbreak. We welcome back to WICC a gentleman who we've had a couple of times on before. He is a civil society leader, an expert on international affairs. He's been executive director of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation since March of 2014. So a little bit better now than 6 years. The executive director, Marion Smith, joins us again. Marion, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Great to be with you again, Paul. I'm well.
Well, Marion, thank you for stopping by. And I wanted to have you on and thank your organizational folks for reaching out to me regarding the scenario here with the communist government of China and the World Health Organization, Marion. And, you know, for folks like you and I who follow this stuff, you and I are sitting back going, well, gee, you know, knock me over with a feather. Surprise, surprise. But, you know, a lot of people, I think, Marion, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of people, I think, may be a little surprised at the influence that the communist government of China has with world health policy, and in particular, the WHO.
You're exactly right. I think a lot of people are waking up to the reality of how the Chinese Communist Party works around the world, including in intergovernmental organizations that are largely funded by the United States and who are ostensibly, you know, acting on our behalf. In the case of the World Health Organization, it is to protect the health and the safety of the world and not to be a politically minded organization. And yet what we see is that the United States is the primary funder of the WHO, while Beijing, the People's Republic of China, primarily controls the organization. And this all goes back to a few years ago when the position of Director General of the WHO was up for grabs, and China campaigned very heavily for the current individual who's in the spot, Dr. Tedros. He doesn't have medical background. He's not a medical doctor, and he beat out a British candidate for the post who was well qualified. And China won that. A lot of people didn't pay attention to that, but we're paying attention now. And that's because Dr. Tedros, in his home country of Ethiopia, was a member of the Marxist Party there. He worked for many years in Ethiopia and Africa, advocating for Chinese investment into Africa as part of China's grand strategy of the Belt Road Initiative. And that includes a political dimension. And so it's no surprise that as China lied in the early days of this pandemic, the WHO and Dr. Tedros was parroting their misinformation. And Americans are realizing now that what happens in China doesn't stay in China. Americans are dying today due to a completely preventable pandemic.
You know, Marion, a lot of people may have locked in on a statement you just made earlier. We pay, but China's the boss here. How is that possible?
Well, I hate to say it, but China has been much more strategic around the world in the last couple of decades than the United States has been. The Chinese Communist Party, which, by the way, last year turned 70 years old in terms of controlling China. The PRC turned 70 last year, and that means it outlived the Soviet Union, which fell apart in its 69th year. And it remains an unreformed single-party Marxist communist dictatorship, totally committed to power, totally against democracy and individual rights and free enterprise. And they've been very clear about that. We in the West have bought into this idea for at least, 30 to 50 years, that if we just engage China, treat them like a responsible international actor, an equal partner, we'll embed them in our international organizations and our institutions, and they will reform. That hasn't happened. far from reforming the Communist Party of China, they have corrupted us. They have corrupted our institutions, and we see that with the WHO. But we see similar things happening. You have the Pan American Health Organization, which operates in the Western Hemisphere, a subsidiary of the WHO. And they just tried to get China, Russia, Cuba, and Venezuela, they just tried to get their person installed as the head of the Pan American Health Organization just last month. And through a campaign that we took part in, luckily and happily, the incumbent, Luis Almagro, a pro-democracy individual, remained in his post, but it was a close call. And so they operate this way everywhere, and at least Americans are now waking up, and hopefully they're going to push back.
What is being peeled back every day here a little more about the Chinese communist influence in the World Health Organization and how that may have, we're learning more and more, stifled early recognition of some scientific aspects of the coronavirus? And Marion, obviously no surprise to folks like you and I that it seemed that Taiwan and anything that Taiwanese scientists were saying at the early outset of the coronavirus was muzzled as pretty effectively by the WHO and Communist China.
You're exactly right. So, you know, there were a number of health organizations around the world who realized that there was an outbreak of a new kind of pneumonia in Wuhan in December. We now know that the first case is recorded as being discovered on November 17th, a fact that China still denies. But at the end of December, you had Taiwan and their health organization writing to the WHO and raising the red flag of human-to-human transmission, which is, of course, what makes these deadly viruses such a danger to the world. The WHO ignored Taiwan and chose to believe the lies of Beijing that there was no human-to-human transmission occurring in China. And that carried through towards mid and late January, those lies being maintained by WHO leadership. That same month, we saw that Beijing activated a global campaign to acquire urgently PPE, or protective equipment, that you only need if you are concerned about human transmission. So they were going up around the world gathering medical supplies, buying up medical supplies in Europe, North America, and elsewhere, at the same time that they were denying human-to-human transmission. And, of course, now we have a shortage of PPE, and there are healthcare workers contracting the virus and dying in Spain and in the United States and elsewhere because of a lack of that PPE. And so that shows not only a willingness by Beijing to lie to the world, a willingness of the WHO to blindly repeat those claims, but also a predatory aspect, that Beijing was willing to lie to the world while snatching up the equipment needed to protect their populations.
And Marion, at least some of the South Asian media outlets, some in Europe now, like the Guardian newspaper out of England and others, and the BBC, at least they are now going headlong into covering this controversy with the WHO and Communist China. Now the WHO is playing a little bit of defense, but here in the U.S., Marion, to me, at least what I have seen, there's been a dearth of coverage on one end of it to see what China really did or didn't do. It seems like all the coverage here, predictably, were the teeth gnashing and head splitting about, oh my God, what did President Trump do? How could he do that? And it seems that the coverage of this, at least by most, Marion, of the mainstream outlets in this country, is political and doesn't get down to the nuts and bolts of why it may be proper what the president did.
You're right. In most European countries, it's now become unavoidable to talk about this because they have, you know, borne the brunt of the death toll early on. And many of them did not shut down flights to China as early as the United States did. And when the U.S. did that, the WHO criticized the United States for shutting down flights from Wuhan, China. just to show the extent to which they were happy to criticize U.S. policy at the same time that they were praising the transparency, believe it or not, the quote-unquote transparency of Beijing in this coronavirus crisis. But here in the United States, I have to say, unfortunately, it has become somewhat politicized. And so, you know, there are media outlets who pretend that to criticize China is to somehow say that the U.S. did everything perfectly, where, you know, it can be both true that China lied, the WHO lied to the world, failed in their number one responsibility. And so every country was less able to prepare for this pandemic. And you can also say that the United States and other countries, not knowing as early as we should have the seriousness of this pandemic, didn't do everything perfectly. But somehow I think there is a political sort of divvying up of the ranks as to those who want to blame the CCP and those who want to blame Donald Trump. And I think that's a very dangerous place to be. There are some things that should be in this country above politics. Our opposition to the Chinese Communist Party and its misuse of organizations that we fund, that should be above politics. And anything that primarily deals with health and safety based on science and the data should certainly also be above politics. So it's unfortunate, and I think the American people should demand better.
Marion, before we wrap up, tell us a little bit about the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation.
Well, we were established due to an authorizing act of Congress to educate Americans about the history, the ideology, the legacy of communism around the world since 1917. We were founded in the early 90s. And today we fight for the freedom of those still living in single-party communist dictatorships around the world. That's one in five people alive today, the majority of those in China. We educate Americans about that history and the ideology. And we memorialize the victims, more than 100 million people killed by communist regimes around the world in the last 100 years. And most recently, we published a timeline that shows the statements and misinformation, the propaganda of the CCP, along with the statements and misinformation of the WHO compared to the reality of the situation as it has unfolded in this pandemic so far. And your listeners can find that at victimsofcommunism.org.
Once again, victimsofcommunism.org. Marion Smith, good to hear from you. We'll be in touch. Take care of yourself. Thank you, Marion.
Thank you.
A lot of folks have kids at home during this coronavirus thing, trying to get into the distance learning thing. Is it frustrating or not? Is it working? Helping us out here understand all that is psychology professor Cheryl Derwin of Southern Connecticut State University to talk about what parents, kids K through 8 are facing with all this. I can only imagine. Professor Derwin, Paul here on WICC. How are you today?
Hi, good. Thanks, Paul.
Well, I got to tell you, you talk about a titanic shift here, Professor. You have millions and millions and millions of kids who were in school with structure, with a teacher, with an authority figure, with mom and dad saying, see you later, when they dropped them off at school or went to the bus with them early in the morning. Everybody was able to get their work done in school or at work. And now what an episode that has turned the country on its ear here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it varies depending on what district you're in, what school you're in, what grade level you're in terms of the amount of structure or lack of structure that some children are getting.
Yeah, you know, and what is your, Professor, what's your overall thought on distance learning? I'm not saying that people can't learn at home, but because we know what colleges do, we know what, you know, continuing education is done for people in the professional mm-hmm. world, like medicine and all that. But you're taking K through 8 and maybe even some high school kids. You're sticking them at home with all the temptations of what's home, the refrigerator, their PlayStation and their Xbox. And you're telling them, but remember, you're in school. I mean, my God, that's tough.
It is. It's definitely difficult. It's even challenging for our own college students as well to make that sudden shift to 100% online teaching and learning. There are absolutely some things that you can't do online, or at least not as well online or remotely as you can in the classroom. And you definitely hit on an important point with the blur between home and school, right? So the line is blurred when you're working from home and learning from home. And I think that's part of what parents need to do, is to create some sort of structure, some schedule, some plan for their children so that, that they do have that structure that they're missing from school.
Yeah, I mean, even if you have kids, and forgive my language here, but even if you have kids who are total jerks at home, that jerkism had to be notched back a little bit because they were in school and they weren't home. And there's a classroom and desks and a teacher and a principal. Mm-hmm. And now that's just for at least the next several months. I'm guessing the whole year here in Connecticut. We won't know till May 20th. I'm guessing that's out the window.
Yes. I think that, you know, parents are definitely, if they weren't before, they're definitely appreciating teachers, K-12 teachers. And that's what I'm hearing. I'm on Twitter a lot in different professional circles. And kudos to the teachers is what the parents are saying.
Right. They're saying, oh, my God, how do you do this all the time?
Yes, all day long. Exactly. I'm in the class in the schools, elementary schools, to do research, literacy research. And I marvel at what the teachers do, you know, on a six-hour basis. I'm only there for an hour, so yeah. Definitely. But parents can really take, you know, some steps. They really need to, depending on the level of the child, first of all, it depends on whether you're dealing with a kindergartner or a first grader or whether you're dealing with a middle schooler or high schooler. So you really need to take developmentally appropriate expectations into effect. But in general, you really want to have a schedule that's set.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing a lot of different things from parents that some teachers are really great, organized. They set out a schedule for the week so you know when you need to be on your Zoom or Google Classroom. And so a set schedule is important, even for parents to be able to work around their work schedule. If you have a kindergartner or a first grader, you can't let them loose on the computer by themselves. They need assistance. So you, for your own sanity, you have to have a schedule.
How the heck do all these kids who are home from K through high school get anything done? Are they really learning? What can a parent do? Psychology professor Cheryl Derwin continues with us for a few minutes from Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, I want to let you finish before we ran into the break there. You were talking about the importance of maintaining a structured schedule in all this.
Yes, absolutely. So having a schedule is important for the students, but also for the parents, especially the parents who need to monitor the younger children online. So it's for their parents' sanity just to know what days they have to do what and when. But we also want to have a designated workspace for the students because this gives them a cue that it's time for learning. And it simulates the conditions that they experience at school, like you mentioned. You know, they're in a structured environment sitting at a desk. So having all of their materials in a designated space tells them this is the learning time and this is what they're doing in that time. Putting electronic devices away as well, that's a big one, especially for the older kids because there's no such thing as multitasking. So full attention to the online learning.
Governor Lamont, as you well know, has not cashed in the school year yet. He's changed the date a couple of times. I think a lot of us in the media, and even he kind of alluded to it when he was on our morning show the other day on WICC, saying, well, you know, the next mile marker will be May 20, and he'll see what happens there. I think, Professor, we all know that to do anything at this late point is probably not going to happen this year. But from a psychological point of view, is that important to wait as long as possible before cashing out the year? Why do you think it's important, if at all, to wait as long as possible and maybe not tell the kids right now, we'll see you in September or late August?
Very important. I think that that we don't want to jump the gun. It gives the students hope. Students left school one day not realizing that they wouldn't come back the next. So they're missing their teachers, they're missing their friends and all of the activities that they no longer have. So kind of pushing that out just holds off hope and it keeps them optimistic. It keeps them motivated to learn. So we don't really want to just say right now, no, we don't have to go back for the end of the year. I'm really hoping I have two children of my own, one still in high school, the other in college. Yeah. And I'm really hoping that even if they can go back in June, I think that's an important thing for closure, just for them to readjust, see their teachers again, kind of wrap up the school year so that they have that, if they're able to do that, if we're at a point, you know, physically where we're able to do that without the social distancing, that's so important for them motivationally to have that closure.
And again, from a psychological point of view, as you probably look at this with your profession, Professor, I mean, obviously for a lot of kids who don't have the best home life, maybe a fractured home, they may be an only child, their school friends, and I've had friends of mine who have been teachers and coaches in school, you know, to a lot of these kids, that's their family, and they're probably missing those people terribly right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. Not only is it their family, we also have to take into consideration many students with special needs that need to get special types of accommodations and services in schools that they're not quite getting or not getting as well as they can through remote learning. Schools and educators and specialists are doing the best they can. We're really proud of everything that they're doing, but there's nothing like being in the school day and the school structure and getting those services, not to mention the students who rely on free reduced lunch and breakfast and things like that. The school provides so many services for so many students that we don't just want to pull the rug out from under them too soon and take that away from them. So give them some hope that they'll be able to come back to that structure before they have to leave for the summer for a couple of months.
A gentleman I used to run into covering sports more on a regular basis years ago, he was a head football coach at a major public high school, and he would tell me part of the day is that he would have, you know, the coach's door was open every day after practice for about 40 minutes, and he said, I had one rule, and that was not to talk football. He said, my door was open for 40 minutes. We would talk about whatever else you needed to talk about, family life, girls, boys, whatever. And he said, Paul, probably in an average year, one-third to half of my squad would have a parent dynamic at home that I would be the sounding board for. And again, these coaches are not there right now.
Right, absolutely. So you raise a very good point. And I've heard of the same thing as well, that adolescents in high school, middle school and high school, they're going through so many changes that the school is an outlet where they can seek that confidant, whether it be a coach or a counselor or a teacher. And, you know, they need that as well. Absolutely. That's a very important service that the schools provide.
Professor, finally, you know, I think we're going to learn a lot about this. We always learn. We always try to take positives out of bad times. You know, one of the things I've been harping on personally is we're going to take a look, I think, from a business point of view as to whether a lot more people can, you know, in fact, work at home and work remotely and not put such a strain on buildings and the environment. Mm-hmm. From your line of work in psychology and education, what do you hope to maybe learn and or research on when this is all done?
Well, I really hope, and I hope this from my own perspective as well in higher education, so it's not only K through 12, but college level learning as well. There are times and opportunities where we can work at home, and I think one of the realizations is that we will see in what circumstances can certain work be done from home. So I think that was a positive benefit of having this happen, that we realized avenues we didn't have before. Although I really hope that education, K through 12 and higher education, realizes that just because we survived the COVID-19 pandemic and remote instruction doesn't mean that 100% remote instruction is always successful, that there are things that we need to learn in the classroom face-to-face, lots of skills that should be face-to-face, and that we want to try to preserve that as best we can.
Yeah, because, of course, your computer at home can't tell you to turn around, spit out the gum, sit up straight, and pay attention, right?
Or the computer also can't recognize when students are having difficulty,
exactly,
where eye contact and posture can really tell you those things in the classroom. So that immediate feedback that you get from that social interaction is missing.
Well, Professor, good luck with your own kids. Thank you for the time. Professor of Psychology at Southern Connecticut State University, Cheryl Derwin. Professor, thank you. Be well, and we'll be in touch. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
The future here in the state of Connecticut. And it's time to think about it. If you look at these numbers, I think obviously the death rate is continuing, and it's so disheartening. But it's a lagging indicator, and the hospitalization, you see the plus 18 is the lowest number we've had in weeks now. Yesterday was up, though, a little bit, but it does give you an idea that there's a trend that's positive for us. The next slide, I think, is indicative. If you could do the next slide, thank you. You'll see that Fairfield County is flattening out a little bit. In fact, their new admissions are down 10%, and that's despite a bit of a spike in Bridgeport. Gives you an idea of the trends there. New Haven is the next line. That as well is flattening out, and their new admissions are down about 35%. Again, a positive trend that we have capacity in our hospitals, and the new admissions, which is an indicator of growth, is slowing. Unfortunately, Hartford, the rate of their hospitalizations were up 30%. And that just reminds you that this is a pandemic that's going to be with us for a while, even though we got to think about what happens next. The last month or two, we've been in the airplane and building it at the same time. And as we've been learning as we go with this fast-changing pandemic, today, as things begin to change, we got to figure out what is a soft landing for that airplane and make sure we do it in a way that we don't bounce back up again, that we get everybody home safely. I just came from a teleconference with the president and vice president, and they'll be announcing very soon their plan. They call it Opening Up America. And it's interesting, there they give guidance, they leave it up to local governors, they leave it up to the regions. One thing I thought was interesting in terms of the metrics that determine how fast you can open, they pointed out that a flu-like symptoms now are probably COVID, because the flu season, the traditional flu season, is behind us. So they look at those symptoms, they look at hospitalization, and they've come up with three phases of slowly being able to thoughtfully open up the economy. But all those three phases, even in those states that are the least affected, they still are going to maintain temperature checks, still maintain testing, maintain social distancing for the near term anyway, just to make sure that we don't let this pandemic get a second life. We've been working hard here at the state level and working with our fellow governors in the region, thinking about how we get our state going again. And we know that it's a business decision, but more importantly, it's a public health decision. And those two are going to be made together with a focus on the public health, something that Dr. Fauci emphasized as well this afternoon. So in a few minutes, I'm going to be introducing the two chair people of our reopened Connecticut advisory board. One is on the business side. Her name is Indra Nooyi. You know that she's a great friend of mine. You remember she was the CEO of Pepsi. You know that she's a chairman of our economic advisory team for the state of Connecticut, along with Jim Smith. And she's leading the business side of this. We have a variety, a number of businesses, large and small, that have signed up and are going to be part of the decision-making process. We're also focusing a lot on those smaller businesses, those service businesses, those that have been most hit by the shutdowns related to the COVID pandemic. Those are restaurants. Those are hospitality. We have labor represented on the committee as well to make sure that each and every one of our workers knows that their safety is a paramount concern to our committee and our opening strategy. On the scientific side of our team is Dr. Albert Koh. He is one of Yale's leading epidemiologists, specializing in infectious diseases. We've had a chance to work with him a little bit when we opened up the field hospital down at Southern. And this is in the course of 5 days. He and Indra have put together an amazing team. Dr. Koh will be able to introduce the folks who specialize in the academics who focus on infectious diseases, the entrepreneurs and others who have come up with a lead in terms of other testing strategies, work on therapies. So we're able to bring the best and the brightest together to advise Connecticut, and Connecticut will be there to advise our fellow governors as Indra and Albert represent us with the other states going forward. They recently did a briefing, recently, like 2 hours ago, with the legislative leadership and maintained that collaboration there. And a special shout out to Senator Len Fasano, who did a lot of work on this and shared his analysis, which is going to be a good part of our thinking. We got to hear from small business people, and obviously the legislative leadership has their ear to the ground when it comes to what they hear from the folks that they're representing. We'll be talking about a couple of things. A, what are those metrics that help determine when the state can begin opening up? And hospitalization is something that both Len and I see as a key criterion, because that tells a lot about capacity in our hospitals and how we can maybe take a few more people out, and in case there's a resurge of some sort, we'll have the hospital capacity to do that. That was also mentioned by Dr. Blix. Secondly, just the testing on infections, testing on immunity. These are going to be the different metrics we use as we figure out how and fast and when we can start opening up the state of Connecticut and our regions. A second criterion will be looking at the different regions, as we've talked about before. And again, in the presidents, they're looking at states as different regions and counties within the very big states. You know, we're a small state, so if you open up something in Pomfret and you close it in Hartford, there's a lot of back and forth. So you got to be careful about thinking too closely in terms of regions. I still tend to think in terms of a state, but every region and every state is different. California is a state that's thinking loudly in terms of regions as well, red, yellow, and green. Just because it's a big state, they have that space there. We're all thinking about demographics, and if you think about opening, what are your priorities? Probably the folks that are least likely to suffer complications from COVID are younger people. I didn't like the piece in the newspaper the other day that said younger people don't get infected. That's not true. But they're least likely to have complications. They're just as likely to infect others. So we're thinking in terms of the demographics as we open as well, both in terms of young people, but also in terms of seniors and older folks who are the most vulnerable. And in all of our metrics, they're going to have to stay self-quarantining longer, both in, I think, the way we're thinking about it, certainly the way the White House Task Force is thinking about it as well. Another metric we're thinking about is just the protective gear. And that's one of the reasons we have May 20th as a decision node, because by May 20th, we'll have a lot of testing done, which gives us some insights into how fast we can go. And we'll also have, I believe, a lot more of the gear, and especially the masks. And the masks are going to be a lead indicator in terms of who next can get back to work, be it in the manufacturing, be it in the grocery, where there'll be requirements for people for the near term. But maybe you're in a nail salon, maybe you're a barber shop, unsafe perhaps right now for those people to go back, especially given the close contact they have with their clients. But with appropriate testing and then with a mask, by appointment, those are ways that we can bring those Main Street businesses back as well. And finally, I'm thinking about the opening strategy in terms of industry groups. We have essential industries and less essential industries, and those that are more high risk and those that are less risk. And obviously, you think of big outdoor construction projects, that's an essential industry that we've kept going because it's essential, and it's also relatively lower risk, especially with the social distancing and the masks. Manufacturing, another essential industry, but higher risk, and very important that we get the protective gear for them and the thermometers so we can test them in terms of fevers. On the other side of the equation is, and this is in the president's report as well, in terms of less essential and high risk would be probably bars. That would be big sports events where there's an opportunity for contagion. So we're going to think in terms of industry groups as other ways that we can focus on our opening strategy. And before I introduce Indra Nooyi, I just want to say that as the president gave us a brief look at what he's thinking about in terms of his opening strategy, mentioned the importance of sports events, and then he threw the ball right to me, and I had to think fast, and I said, I want you to know that the Travelers Golf Tournament will be played in Connecticut in June with no fans. It'll be a different experience. But we're thinking as well in terms of how we open up our state in a very thoughtful way that puts our folks at the least risk, mitigates the risk of a second surge in this, and make sure our seniors can stay safe. With that, I'd really love to introduce, reintroduce Indra Nooyi to you, who's come out of nowhere in the last week to help get this group organized. And tell us what you've learned, Indra.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to serve you and the citizens of Connecticut as a co-chair of this task force with the incredible Dr. Albert Koh, from whom I'm learning so much every day. And I'll just make one correction. I thought New York Yankees baseball was essential business. I guess not. But our goal on this task force is to, on this advisory group, is to develop a plan to reopen Connecticut as soon and as safely as possible. As soon and as safely as possible. And the way we want to do it is using fact-based analysis, very carefully considering the public health consequences of anything we do. And we want to make sure whatever we come up with is a sustainable approach, because the worst outcome is reopen Connecticut and we have to reverse direction. We don't want that to happen. So we want to have a sustainable approach, carefully considering public health. So Dr. Koh will talk about the public health perspective on when we can reopen. So Dr. Koh.
Thank you, Andrews. And I also want to thank the governor for the privilege to serve the state and work with, especially with Indra and the member of the advisory board. So I think when we're thinking about where we need to go, you know, we first have to answer, before we answer the question of how we're going to go to reopen the state, we need to identify where we need to go. And the first criteria is that we have to have a decline in cases and hospitalizations. This is not only important in terms of controlling the outbreak, but we need to make sure that we're out of the surge and that we protect our hospitals. The second criteria is that is really the fundamentals of public health prevention and control. We need to implement mass testing, contact tracing, and self-isolation. This is testing all individuals who are sick, whether they're in the hospital or at the home, trace their contacts, and then have those contacts that are infected self-isolate.
I want to welcome somebody who I check in with from time to time who has his finger on the pulse of what is going on with a group of people that really, many of whom are encountering things they probably never thought they would. Despite all the insurance you could have, all the extra funding you can have, we are in uncharted times. Tim Phelan heads the Connecticut Retail Merchants Association. Tim, how are you? How you holding up?
I'm good, Paul. Thanks. I'm healthy, and my family's healthy, so I'm very grateful for that. How are you?
I'm good. I'm all right. I'm doing this from my sumptuous palace here in Wallingford, so it's all good. You know, Tim, a spare bedroom always comes in. You know, once the kid is old enough, and now he's living in New York City, so his old bedroom turns into a studio. The air mattress he used to use is now sound insulation. Anyway, Tim, I'll just ask you the opening question here, the broad question. Yeah. What are you hearing from retailers, from your members on this one?
Yeah, this is a really difficult time for many of our members. They are all really trying to adjust to this new environment that they're in. Some, quite honestly, some of them are super busy because they're essential retailers, and others are obviously they're not. There's a vast majority of them that are not essential retailers, and they have to figure out a way to continue to operate and keep their businesses going. Fortunately for Connecticut, a non-essential retailer still has some options under the executive order that the governor did in respect that they can, you know, still do some curbside delivery to customers, and to the extent that they have communication to customers through email or through their websites, they can still try to, you know, generate sales. But it's not nearly remotely close to what, you know, a typical, work week or sales would look like.
And Tim, I mean, this is really new territory, and it's not just that easy, as you mentioned, and I always mention this when it comes to food establishments. You know, these establishments, Tim, that are used to having seated customers, whether it's a big restaurant, a small restaurant, or a diner, yeah, they in the past, they've had people take stuff to go or an order to go here and there, but to just flip the switch and turn into one of those retailers is not that easy.
Oh, no, it's definitely not. And they're under a tremendous amount of stress. So it's almost like their business has been flipped upside down. And it's challenging for many of them. And I think under the circumstances, you're seeing a lot of creativity and you're seeing a lot of ingenuity on the part of some of these, particularly restaurants, but also, brick and mortar retailers that are still trying to, you know, remain relevant and stay open in a sense of, being able to deliver products to customers. And they just have to, you know, hope that, like we all do, that we could get behind this as soon as possible and we could get back to a normal, you know, business climate.
Hey, Tim, you know, there were a lot of these retailers and businesses like restaurants, like diners, even people that were still selling things like books and electronics and cameras and things like that. The smaller shops that had the small margins that were trying to survive before this. I got to imagine that, unfortunately, some of these people are not going to be able to make it back. I mean, are you hearing that or not?
Well, I haven't heard that specifically. You know, I'm not sure people want to reach out to me and tell me that they're not going to make it, but I think your perception about it is probably, you know, accurate. You know, each individual business owner has their own financial sort of stress test that they can survive under. And some of them may have different, reserve funds that they could tap into or lines of credit from banks and things like that. And others don't. And that's just the nature of the way they work is that they, in many cases, a smaller independent retailer may be able to go 2 or 3 months without any revenue before it really starts to affect them. Some may have shorter periods of time. And that isn't the case with larger multi-state retailers as well. I mean, if you're a big box retailer that's non-essential now, you can't just continue to operate forever without any customers. Eventually, you're gonna have to close, or you're gonna have to make some really hard decisions about your future. So it's certainly more acute with smaller retailers because their margins of are so much smaller. But this impact, this sort of pause or shutdown or whatever you want to call it, is across the board, and it impacts all types of retailers, large and small. Everybody is feeling the pinch on this.
Tim, do you think the retailers out there, are they well-versed now, do you think, after a few weeks of knowing what state programs are available, the bridge loans, which I guess were tapped out pretty early, but I know they're trying for more. Is there enough to help these retailers, Tim, or should there be more from the government?
Well, I think to answer your first question, yes, I do. I think the SBA and the various Connecticut banks and chambers of commerce, for that matter, kudos to them. They've done a great job of notifying the general business community of the availability of loans through the SBA and through the CARES Act that passed. So yeah, I think that they're certainly well aware of that, and I'm sure. I haven't seen the statistics on it, but I know saw the same story you did, that the money is for the PPP program is tapped out. I know that the governor's initial initiative for small business loans also was tapped out within a couple of days, and he had to put some more money in that. So there's definitely awareness of various programs, but I also think that the best thing that we can do is to just try to get this virus behind us try to get the state reopened again as fast as and as safely as possible, so that, you know, we could get economic activity moving again. Because small retailers and small business owners are not interested in taking more loans out. They're more interested in getting revenue back in, paying their rent, paying their employees, you know, getting an operating business up and running again. The short-term forgivable loans are welcome, and they need that in order to get through this. But, another round of federal funding through the SBA, which would mean more loans, that's not necessarily something that they're clamoring for, as opposed to, you know, if they could get some relief for rent, that would help. If they could get some, I know the utilities have been generous in terms of, you know, continuing electric bills for that, you know, non-payment electric bills. If they could get some help from the state in terms of when they reopen, maybe some stimulus there. But most importantly, they just want to get back to work. They want to get customers back in their stores, and that's the most important thing to help them, you know, recover.
And on that, we thank you. Tim, be good. Tim Phelan heads the Connecticut Retail Merchants Association. Tim, take care, and we'll connect down the road. Thanks, buddy.
Okay, Paul. Stay safe.